If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are warning everybody. Not a single state apart from Russia has ever shelled nuclear reactors. It is the first time in our history, in the history of humankind, that the terrorist state turned to nuclear terrorism.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russia of nuclear terror after Russian forces shelled the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, sparking a fire that took hours to put out. Russian forces have now seized control of the plant. We'll go to Ukraine for the latest, plus speak to a leading Russian environmentalist about the attack, as well as Russia's escalating crackdown on civil society.
It's very important to stop the war now, and it's very important that Ukraine stays free.
Plus, we speak to a Ukrainian-American journalist who says the Ukraine of his childhood is being erased. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's military says it's taken over the Zaporizhzhia power plant in Ukraine after its forces opened fire on the nuclear facility overnight with rockets, artillery and gunfire. The assault sparked a fire that burned for hours, though it reportedly did not spread to any of the nuclear plant's 6 reactors, and there's no sign of an increase in radiation levels at the site. The nuclear plant's operator says managers are now working at gunpoint. Zaporizhzhia is the largest nuclear power station in Europe and the 10th largest in the world. Nuclear experts have been warning for weeks of the risk of a catastrophic meltdown. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. News of the assault drew international alarm. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. U.S. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts tweeted, "This would be an international war crime by Putin that could result in incredible devastation." Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of nuclear terror.
Europeans, please wake up. Tell your politicians. Russian troops are shooting at the nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, city of Enerhodar. There are 6 nuclear reactors there. 6. In Chernobyl, it was only 1 reactor, which exploded.
The nuclear crisis came as Russia laid siege to major cities and intensified artillery and missile attacks on heavily populated urban areas in Ukraine. The southern city of Mariupol has been encircled by Russian forces and subjected to intense strikes. Elsewhere, large explosions shook central Kyiv Friday, while Russian forces in the occupied city of Kherson encountered a hostile response from city residents. In Moscow, President Vladimir Putin said the assault is going as planned.
Dear comrades, I want to say that the special military operation is proceeding strictly in line with the timetable, according to plan. I will never give up my conviction that Russians and Ukrainians are one people.
French President Emmanuel Macron spoke with Putin Thursday, saying after the call he feared the worst is yet to come and that Russia wants to seize all of Ukraine. The Committee to Protect Journalists has identified a camera operator who died Tuesday when Russian forces blew up a television tower in Kyiv. 49-year-old Yevgeny Sakun was among five people killed in the attack. He worked for the Ukrainian television station Live, which had covered the Russian invasion. In Moscow, Russian authorities on Thursday ordered two TV and radio broadcasters off the air over their coverage of the invasion of Ukraine. Echo of Moscow was one of Russia's oldest radio stations. Meanwhile, workers at the independent station TV Rain held an on-air protest to conclude its final broadcast Thursday. A news anchor's last words were, "No to war," before staffers walked off the set. They then fled their workplace after learning special forces were preparing to storm the building. This is TV Rain's general director, Natalia Sendiva.
We can't compare war, catastrophe, and terrible tragedy where people are dying every day, which is happening now, to our situation. But we are also at war, because we are working in conditions of war. We have too many restrictions, and for every mistake, we pay not with our lives, but with our jobs.
Meanwhile, the Russian state-funded news outlet RT America has suspended its productions and laid off most of its staff. This comes after RT America was dropped by major U.S. distributors, including DirecTV, and after YouTube, TikTok, and Facebook also blocked access to Russian state-funded outlets to its users in Europe. In Geneva, Switzerland, the UN Human Rights Council has voted to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine and to establish a commission of inquiry into war crimes. The vote came after investigators from the International Criminal Court left The Hague for Ukraine to collect evidence of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and acts of genocide committed by Russia's military. British-Pakistani lawyer Karim Khan will lead the prosecution.
I think the world is watching, and the world expects better. Humanity expects better than we're getting around the world, and Ukraine is no exception.
The White House said the U.S. would work closely with the ICC to support its investigation. Russia and Ukraine have not ratified the Rome Statute that established the International Criminal Court. Neither has the United States. In 2020, then-President Trump sanctioned ICC prosecutors over the court's investigations into Israel's treatment of Palestinians, as well as war crimes committed by U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said Thursday it suspended deportation flights to Ukraine amidst Russia's invasion. Meanwhile, the Biden administration said it'll allow Ukrainians living in the United States to apply for temporary protected status, TPS, which would shield them from deportation and grant them work permits. Arizona Democratic Congress member Raul Grijalva tweeted, "The Biden admin should also designate TPS for non-white, war-stricken countries like Ethiopia, Cameroon, Mauritania, Afghanistan, Mali, and others," he said. U.S. lawmakers have introduced a bipartisan bill that would ban imports of crude oil, petroleum, petroleum products, liquefied natural gas and coal from Russia over its assault on Ukraine. The White House, however, opposes such a ban, citing worries over supply issues and price hikes at the gas pump. Germany and other European nations continue to import large amounts of natural gas from Russia, despite EU sanctions. Last week, German energy giant E.ON said it had no plans to shut down the flow of gas from the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. Thousands of youth climate activists took to the streets around the globe Thursday in solidarity with Ukraine. This is Carla Reitzma of Germany's Fridays for Future speaking from Berlin.
This war is a fossil war, and that means that one of the solutions must be the rapid phase-out of coal, oil, and gas. It's important to stop Russian fossil fuels and, accordingly, radically expand renewables and accelerate an energy transition.
Fridays for Future also tweeted, "While Ukrainians deserve immediate peace and all our support, so do the people from Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and all war-torn regions. Empathy, justice, and compassion should be for everyone," they said. In Pakistan, at least 30 people were killed, more than 60 injured, after a bomb exploded inside a Shia mosque in Peshawar during Friday morning prayers. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, which Prime Minister Imran Khan quickly condemned. He's been accused by Pakistan's Shia Muslims and other minority groups of failing to halt attacks by Sunni extremists. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing the U.S. government to block two psychologists who orchestrated the CIA's torture program after 9/11 from testifying in a case in Poland brought by Guantanamo prisoner and torture survivor Abu Zubaydah. Zubeda, who's been in U.S. custody since 2002 and imprisoned without charge, had called on CIA psychologists James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen to prove he'd been illegally detained and tortured in a CIA black site in Poland. In a 6-3 ruling Thursday, Supreme Court justices said the government has the power to prevent the public disclosure of so-called state secrets that purportedly threaten national security. In Louisville, Kentucky, a jury has acquitted former officer Brett Hankison, who is accused of wanton endangerment for shooting into Breonna Taylor's neighbor's apartment during a botched no-knock raid that led to Taylor's killing in 2020.
Mr. Hankison, this jury has found you not guilty. This court, therefore, finds that you are not guilty of these charges. You are free to go, and your bond will be released.
Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, wrote on social media, quote, "To be clear, these charges were not for Breonna Taylor, but nevertheless, he should have been found guilty." The not guilty verdict comes nearly 2 years after Breonna Taylor's killing. On March 13, 2020, plainclothes officers serving a no-knock warrant broke down the door of Taylor's home in the middle of the night and shot her dead. Taylor was a black 26-year-old emergency medical technician and aspiring nurse. No police officers have been charged with her killing. Florida state lawmakers voted Thursday to ban most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The measure, which now heads to Republican Governor Ron DeSantis' desk, is modeled on a Mississippi abortion law that the Supreme Court is currently weighing and which could essentially undo Roe v. Wade. In other news from Florida, students across the state walked out of class Thursday to protest Republicans' new anti-LGBTQ plus education legislation known as the Don't Say Gay Bill. "We say gay," they chanted. The bill would ban discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. Meanwhile, in Iowa, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signed a new law banning transgender girls and women from school sports. Iowa's the 11th state to ban transgender athletes. Legal challenges are expected. Here in New York City, a man's been charged with hate crimes after a spate of attacks on seven women of Asian descent Sunday. Over a two-hour period, Stephen Zajunk punched the women in the face. One was pushed to the ground. Two were treated at the hospital for their injuries. Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family have agreed to a new $6 billion deal with a group of states that previously rejected the company's bankruptcy plan. Like previous deals, money would go towards addiction treatment, and the Sacklers would give up control of Purdue, maker of OxyContin. It would also shield the billionaire Sackler family from current and future civil suits over their role in fueling the devastating opioid epidemic. And tech workers at the New York Times voted overwhelmingly to unionize with the News Guild of New York, the same union that already represents some 1,300 editorial staff at the newspaper. The final vote comes after an extended anti-union campaign by the New York Times, including allegations of illegal interference in workers' organizing efforts. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russia of nuclear terror after Russian forces shelled and then seized the largest nuclear power plant in Europe overnight. Russia's shelling of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant sparked a fire that burned for hours, but it reportedly did not spread to any of the plant's six reactors. Zelensky recorded a brief video message after the plant was attacked.
"The Russian military has to be stopped. Call on your politicians immediately. Ukraine has 15 nuclear reactors. If there is a nuclear explosion, this will be the end of everybody, the end of Europe. This will mean the evacuation of the whole Europe. Only immediate action from Europe can stop the Russian troops. Don't let Europe die in a nuclear catastrophe."
In a message posted on Facebook, Ukraine's nuclear regulatory body said Russian forces have captured the plant, but that Ukrainian workers are continuing to work on the premises. The regulatory body warned, quote, "loss of the possibility to cool down nuclear fuel will lead to significant radioactive releases into the environment that could, quote, exceed all previous accidents at nuclear power plants, including the Chernobyl accident and the accident at Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant," end quote. World leaders have denounced Russia shelling of the nuclear power plant. The U.S. Embassy in Kyiv has accused Russia of committing a war crime. Meanwhile, the Russian military has accused Ukrainian forces of setting part of the plant on fire, describing it as a, quote, "horrible provocation." The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, however, said the plant was hit by a Russian projectile. Grossi offered to meet with Russia and Ukraine to ensure no other nuclear plants are targeted in the fighting.
We, of course, are fortunate that there was no release of radiation and that the integrity of the reactors in themselves was not compromised, but yes, the plant in a wider sense. But it is obvious that when we all agree on these principles, words must mean something, and we have to act in consequence. So for us, the IAEA, it is time for action. We need to do something about this. I have indicated to both the Russian Federation and the Ukraine my availability and disposition to travel to Chernobyl as soon as possible so that these seven crucial pillars are never again compromised. The idea behind this initiative of mine as Director General of the IAEA is to agree on a framework and on a compromise that would commit to not compromise these principles that we all subscribe and agree to.
Again, that's Rafael Grossi, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Critics of nuclear power have been warning for weeks of the dangers posed of a war in an area so heavily dependent on nuclear power. Ukraine has 15 nuclear power reactors at four facilities around the country, as well as the deactivated reactors at the Chernobyl nuclear disaster site. In 1986, one of Chernobyl's four reactors exploded, precipitating the worst nuclear accident in history. Last week, Russian forces captured the Chernobyl site, presumably to open the highly contaminated Chernobyl exclusion zone for their military drive to Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital. We're joined now by three guests. In western Ukraine, Oleksiy Pasyuk is with us, deputy director of the Ukrainian NGO EcoAction, where his focus is on energy and nuclear energy. In Berlin, Germany, we're joined by Vladimir Slivliak, a co-chair of the leading Russian environmental organization EcoDefense. He won the 2021 Right Livelihood Award, the alternative Nobel Peace Prize, for defending the environment and mobilizing grassroots opposition to the coal and nuclear industries in Russia, where he's usually based. And in Edinburgh, Scotland, Sean Burney is with us, the senior nuclear specialist with Greenpeace. He just co-authored a report on severe nuclear hazards at Zaporizhzhia plant in Ukraine. The report says the only solution is an immediate end to war. Oleksiy Pasyuk, we're going to begin with you in western Ukraine. Talk about what you understand took place and what the threat is right now, not only to all of Ukraine.
Hello, everybody. Well, I have to stress that this risk was discussed already back in 2014, because there was already—I mean, we are in war, basically, since then, and we had already military operations, but then it was maybe like 200 kilometers away from Zaporizhzhia, and that was already an issue of concern. I think all of us here as nuclear specialists would agree that there is a high risk, and you have to realize that the risk is not necessarily from direct shooting into the reactor. It's a very complex system where the main issue is constantly cooling nuclear fuel, either it's in reactor or on the site. And this is the main concern, that even without a kind of massive hit to one of the reactors, we might lose control of what is on the station, and it can cause to the melting fuel and scenarios similar to Fukushima.
Oleksiy, I just wanted to ask you very quickly to give us the lay of the land of Ukraine when it comes to nuclear power. One of the most nuclear power dependent countries in Europe, what, 50% of the energy comes from nuclear power. You've got the Chernobyl in the north, and then explain the significance of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear complex, a massive complex, one of the largest in the world.
Yeah. So, indeed, it have happened that Ukrainian policy was not very good by constantly increasing a part of nuclear and electricity production. I mean, without increasing new capacities, we were just cutting on everything else. And that brought us a situation when we have now 15 units in the country. Yes, indeed, at certain time we are getting over 50% of electricity, and it basically means that each of the reactors produce about, say, 5% of consumption in any single point, and then stopping each of it will have a significant impact on electricity production. So it's another kind of side of the story rather than a nuclear accident itself. What we have seen, for example, in Chernobyl site, where Russians came and took it over control, that they prevent stuff from rotating and it increases, say, pressure on the staff of the nuclear facilities. I mean, in previous stories where we had some kind of accidents, it would often be a human error, which lead to kind of significant consequences. And that's one of the worry which we have. Yeah. I would also maybe know that at currently Ukraine is disconnected from neighbors, and our electricity sector is working in insulation. So if something goes wrong with some of the units, it will be difficult to maintain the integrity of the system and providing electricity. And unfortunately, we saw that it's now a deliberate target by a Russian army. We saw in smaller cities where there is resistance locally that there were airstrikes towards other energy-producing facilities and heating, central heating system, basically putting pressure on civilians to kind of give up resistance.
So if you could also tell us, both we've heard reports at Chernobyl, which is the route that the Russian army coming from Belarus goes through to get to Kyiv, that they're holding the staff hostage, that they're under enormous pressure there. And then we're hearing that at Zaporizhia, managers are being held at gunpoint to continue operating the plant. Do you have any news of either situation?
Well, this makes it difficult because it's one of the tasks of Russian military to stop kind of communication, which is also disappointing with the mainland. So they keep only, I mean, with the outside world, they keep one official line and then all communication is going through that. And it's difficult to get the full picture of what is happening. In Chernobyl, there were opportunities kind of to observe from outside, like radiation meters in the days when there were escalation in Chernobyl zone. We had a spike in measurements from the radioactivity in kind of equipment. So on Zaporizhia, maybe you saw there are like webcams, so you can see some of the site. I think it would likely go to the same scenario of blocking people on the side. And it's currently a Russian strategy to block cities and facilities. That's why one of the big communication from Ukrainian government is to keep like corridors to have people movement and to avoid catastrophes of different kind, either humanitarian or, in this case, technical.
And your response to the director general of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, offering to go to Chernobyl to mediate between the Ukrainians and the Russians around the safety of these nuclear plants, Alexei?
Well, we, of course, from one hand, appreciate the reaction of international community, but in Ukraine, we feel that even more should be done. And you should understand that it's also happening at the same moment when UN institutions trying to figure out what wording they use for this war, because they're afraid to call things what they are, and they're talking of conflicts and that kind of things. And also reaction of bigger countries which are part of international atomic energy, like India. It would be nice that they will be much more louder. And of course, it's a pity to see that inside of Russia, people who know very well what nuclear industry is and who are responsible for nuclear safety, that they don't put inside of the country pressure on Putin, basically saying that's what should be avoided because it's a very real threat for a very huge amount of people.
Alexei, I want to go for a minute from Western Ukraine, where you are, to Sean Burney. He's just outside Edinburgh in Scotland. You are the Greenpeace co-author of this new report on the severe hazards of the very plant where the fire broke out after the, well, what the IAEA says was a Russian projectile. Again, Russia is saying this is staged or the Ukrainians set fire to get the international community involved. Sean. Can you put this in a national, in a global context, the significance of what's happening at Zaporizhzhia and even the occupation of the Chernobyl plant that's closed?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a unique moment in the history of nuclear power. From the 1940s onwards, no state has been invaded with such a large nuclear power program. And nuclear reactors are vulnerable to many, many events, many accidents. We've seen Chernobyl, Fukushima, Daiichi in 2011. But this is the first time we've seen a deliberate attack on a country which operates such large number of nuclear reactors. So we're in new territory here. None of these reactors, and that applies to all the 94 reactors in the United States as much as it does to Ukraine, none of these commercial power reactors were designed to withstand deliberate armed attack. The containment are extremely vulnerable, either deliberately or by accident, that to be hit by projectiles. The key issue, and Alexei knows this well, as does Vladimir, is the cooling function for the reactor cores, not just if the reactors are operating, but also the spent fuel. And in the case of Zaporizhzhia, in 2017, and that's the last data we have, there was over 2,200 tons of highly radioactive spent fuel. Over 800 tons of that were in reactor pools. And these pools need to be constantly cooled with a reliable electrical supply, which is generally from off-site to the power plant. And, of course, in the time of war, the stability of the grid cannot be guaranteed. And at that point, the nuclear power plant is dependent upon its own electrical power system, in this case, emergency diesel generators, which have to kick in extremely fast. The amount of energy and heat in this nuclear fuel, either in the core or in the spent fuel pools, is such that you need massive amounts of electricity just to power the pumps to cool the fuel. And that is, in some cases, the sort of worst-case scenario, that there will be an off-site event that will cut down the electricity supply. And then you're moving towards, very rapidly, the heating of the fuel, whether in the pools or in the reactors. And you see scenarios very close and beyond what we saw in Fukushima Daiichi. So, yeah, we're in a very, very difficult situation here. I'm not particularly impressed, however, by the International Atomic Energy Agency. It spent 65 years since its foundation in 1957 promoting nuclear power, including in Eastern Europe, defending the operation of these reactors and justifying them, saying that they can be safely operated. Well, the IAEA now is trying to claim that it's going to come to the rescue. That's just not credible.
Why?
The IAEA basically has an interest in downplaying. So, for example, this morning's press conference, Director Grossi was asked specifically a question on spent fuel at Zaporizhzhia, and his response was like one word. There is no, two words, three words. There's no issue. Well, sorry, there's hundreds of tons of spent fuel in cooling ponds inside the reactor containment that are absolutely dependent on electrical supply off-grid in a war zone. That's an issue. The diesel generators, and Alexei knows this far better than I, there's ongoing questions over the last years that have been raised about the reliability of the diesel generators, Russian supplied, and since 2014, serious problems in terms of replacement parts. So, yeah, there is a big issue with spent fuel, but according to the IAEA this morning, it's not an issue.
I mean, you have the city, for example, of Mariupol in the south, where the reports are the bombardment has cut power, water and heat. What that would mean if power and water in particular, where spent fuel rods are put, and if there isn't water, would melt down, means for a power plant, Sean?
Well, I worked in Japan for more than 30 years and started working in Fukushima Prefecture in 1995. And I knew there was a serious problem with the plants in terms of seismic resistance. Never expected three reactors to suffer meltdown in a matter of hours. And, you know, it's a very difficult situation. We, of course, are clearly opposed to nuclear power. We get accused of exaggerating the risks and the threats, and we're in a war situation. The people of Ukraine are suffering on so many different levels. How do you talk about these subjects without being accused of exaggerating the risks? And we don't want to do that. The scenarios are, the variables are enormous. One reactor, six reactors, the 15 reactors in the Ukraine. So you've got to be a little bit careful, but you also need to try and explain what those vulnerabilities are. And what we've looked at with this latest assessment is that a 30-kilometer exclusion zone, a no-fly zone, they will reduce in some ways the hazards. But actually, particularly because of this issue of the dependence on the grid, the only way that you can remove the military risk to these reactors is to end the war immediately. The other risks will continue. The contamination exists in Chernobyl. That will not go away. The hazards from the reactors, even if there's no war, they are there. And that's why Alexei and others, EcoAction, over the years and years, have been challenging the Ukrainian authorities. Today is not the time to be talking about that. But the IAEA, they're part of the problem here. They have justified the operation of these reactors, which are targets in war. And it will be the people of Ukraine, but also potentially wider Eastern Europe, Western Europe, that will be the victims. They're already the victims of this war. The last thing they need is to be faced with a nuclear disaster.
I want to bring Vladimir Slivyak into this conversation. And it's very important that we have both Alexei speaking to us from Western Ukraine, Alexei Pasyuk, a Ukrainian anti-nuclear leader, environmental leader with the NGO EcoAction, and Vladimir Slivyak, who is with the Russian organization EcoDefense, usually lives in Russia. We're speaking to him in Berlin. He won the 2021 Right Livelihood Award, the Alternative Nobel Prize, for defending the environment and mobilizing grassroots opposition to the coal and nuclear industry. If you could comment on what this means, and it's unusual to have a Russian and a Ukrainian, I dare say, anti-war and a pro-environment activist in this conversation. Vladimir, if you'd like to say something first to Alexei in Western Ukraine.
Well, first of all, I agree with everything that my colleagues just said. We are on the brink of a new nuclear disaster, and there are 15 nuclear reactors in Ukraine right now, but only one is enough to repeat what happened in Chernobyl back in 1986 or in Fukushima, if you like. And I think the war should be stopped right now. Otherwise, it's going to be, well, I just really don't want to think about what it will be if war will not be stopped.
So can you talk about the significance of this? And from your understanding, as a Russian who lives in Russia right now, you're traveling through Berlin, what do you think President Putin is intending right now?
Well, President Putin wants to take over Ukraine for reasons he probably knows. I don't know what are those reasons. He attacked neighboring country. He put at risk people there. He actually ordered the Russian army to go and kill people there and maybe even go and attack and take over control of nuclear power plants in Ukraine. This is what's obviously going on. And I don't think anyone in Russia actually understand why Putin had to start this war and what's the reason for what's going on. I mean, maybe some closest friends of Putin knows, but in general, Russian public, no one really understands what's going on and why Russia started this war. And there are thousands of people going in the street every day in Russia, in the many places, in the protesting, and they get arrested, they get beaten, they get jailed. There was over 7,000 of people arrested since the war started. I think it's a total disaster what's going on, and it will affect not only Ukraine, it will also affect Russia very much.
You have long been an activist in Russia, deeply concerned about the dependence on fossil fuel and Europe's dependence on Russia. Can you put this in the larger picture of that, of your work?
Well, my organization existed for 30 years, and we've been all the time opposing nuclear power for various reasons and fossil fuel as well. We've been doing a lot of activities on climate. And obviously, if there is war going on, I mean, we cannot really think anymore about energy transition or just energy transition, climate change and climate action and everything like that. All of it just stopped. I mean, there is no room anymore to think about it, to lobby government over this. I think, I mean, if anyone actually hoped that Russia will do something for climate, now, I mean, there is no hope anymore. And I don't think when, if Russia ever come back to doing something for climate, I don't know when exactly that will be happening.
Vladimir, I'm going to ask you to stay on for our next segment. So, talked about the crackdown on protest and speech in Russia. But I want to end this segment. The fire at the Zaporizhzhia plant, the concern about what's going to happen with nuclear power. But I want to go back to Alexei Pasyuk with the Ukrainian NGO EcoAction. And you are also, I mean, a Ukrainian-Russian. You live now. You are in Western Ukraine. You are undergoing this assault on your country. Your final thoughts and what it means to be a Ukrainian-Russian?
Well, I'm not Ukrainian-Russian. There is a little bit of confusion about it. I use Russian language in everyday life, and that's why I think was the message.
Alexei, what percentage of Ukrainians speak Russian?
It's difficult to say, but I think we kind of looking into why it was an issue is because Putin is basically saying Russia is wherever somebody speaks Russian and we are going to Ukraine to save Russians, basically. And the interesting part of it, that the most people who are now most suffering are Russian-speaking Ukrainian and Russians who live close to Russian border. And that makes the whole story particularly crazy because it completely undermines even the propaganda kind of rhetoric which Putin has. So, we have to understand that Ukraine have been in some kind of war since 2014. There is also Crimea, there is Eastern Ukraine, and the attitude. I was amazed even in 2014 when the Crimean war. When Russia occupied Crimea, that there was still some kind of sympathy towards Russian altogether in Ukraine. You would have like 60% have positive attitudes to Russian who started the war in Ukraine, while very small percentage of Russians with positive attitude to Ukrainians based on the kind of pools, because there was a massive propaganda in Russia. And it's amazing how much this policy of Putin to kind of protect Russians basically turned everyone against him in any neighboring state. And at this moment, basically, everybody in Ukraine, all citizens in Ukraine, no matter on what nation they are, because we are many nationalities in the country, are standing together, and they're ready to protect their country, and they're fighting sometimes with their bare hand. And everybody should understand that this is a massive resistance, and we really hope to get support from everyone, particularly European leaders and international institutions and U.S. And it unfortunately would not work by saying, let's stop war. Russians don't understand international treaties. I mean, Putin. There is a simple International Atomic Agency agreement not to use nuclear facilities like we have now in a situation of war. They ignore any international norms. So, unfortunately, we have to show very strong resistance, including military, to stop this.
Alexei Pasyuk, I want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Director of the Ukrainian NGO EcoAction, speaking to us from Western Ukraine. Please stay safe. Sean Burney is with Greenpeace. We're going to link to your report just outside Edinburgh, Scotland, on nuclear power and the analysis on severe nuclear hazards at the Zaporizhzhia plant in Ukraine, which you put out before the fire. And Vladimir Slivlyak, please stay with us, co-chair of the Russian organization EcoDefense. We're going to talk when we come back about Russia's escalating crackdown on civil society. Back in 30 seconds. Kleine Nacht music by Mozart, performed by the Rivne Symphony inside a mall in Rivne, Ukraine, that I recorded in 2018 after the UN Climate Summit in Poland flew to Lviv, or Lviv, as it is called by Ukrainians, to visit my grandmother's birthplace in Rivne, Ukraine. She was born in 1897 and lived till she was 108 years old. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to look at Russia's escalating crackdown domestically following its invasion of Ukraine, more than 8,000 anti-war protesters have been arrested since Russia began the attack. Meanwhile, Russia's lower house of parliament has just passed a new law to criminalize the distribution of what the state considers to be false news about military operations, like calling the attack war. Violators of the law could face 15 years in prison. Still with us, Vladimir Slivyak. He is co-chair of the leading Russian environmental organization EcoDefense, won the 2020 Right Livelihood Award, the alternative Nobel Peace Prize for defending the environment and mobilizing grassroots opposition to the coal and nuclear industries in Russia. Vlad, your response to the anti-war protests across Russia, thousands have been arrested. And talk about what people understand. What is the feeling in Russia and Putin's crackdown?
Well, first of all, I think it's very hard to imagine for people in the West or in USA or a European Union, how Russian propaganda is working. I mean, you've gotten access to different sources of information, to different TV channels, and Russians don't have this. The big majority, like over 70% of Russians, are just watching the first channel of the TV, which is state-controlled, and that put out all kinds of propaganda, anti-Ukrainian propaganda, to make people believe that in Ukraine, something bad is happening to Russian-speaking people, which is absolutely not true, and just a pure propaganda to justify this invasion. But I mean, I was a bit surprised, actually, that even in a dictatorship country like Russia, and Russia is dictatorship today, people actually went to protest, and the thousands of people went in the street. And I mean, although it's still not that mass protest, but even this number, I think it's well over 10,000 of people that went to protest since the beginning. Well, it's pretty impressive taking into account what's going on in Russia, how media controlled, how much repression is there right now. That's my take.
And what about the media outlets that have been shut down, like RAIN, like Echo of Moscow? Explain their significance.
Well, it is very significant. Independent media are not big, unfortunately, and that's because over the last decade, Putin was basically shutting down every influential independent media in the country. And those two are, well, right now we have only one more or less independent media in the country, which is Novaya Gazeta, or a new newspaper, if you translate it. Which still puts a lot of anti-war propaganda, not propaganda, but anti-war information. So we are left with only one newspaper that presents alternative point of view. And I think it could be shut down as well. But the Echo of Moscow and the TV RAIN being the main sources of information, of alternative to governmental information, in a country like Russia with 150 million of people. Now people cannot really get this alternative information anymore.
And it's also interesting to note that in occupied Kherson now, in the south of Ukraine, that the Ukrainian television has been turned off, and they're now getting Russian government media.
Yeah, well, I mean, Putin for a very long time been doing... a crackdown not only on the civil society, but also on the free media. And I mean, what we see today in Russia is a result of this policy, when the whole structures of a civil society basically destroyed, there are almost no organizations left who can actually organize mass protests. And Putin also shutting down free media, so people cannot get independent information. And yes, this is exactly what he will do to Ukraine if he will ever take it over.
I wanted to ask you about Dmitry Medvedev, the deputy head of Russia's Security Council chaired by Putin, who also warned that Moscow could restore the death penalty after Russia was removed from Europe's top rights group, the UN Human Rights Group. A chilling statement that shocked human rights activists in a country that has not had capital punishment for a quarter of a century. I'm reading a report.
That is absolutely shocking. But looking at what Russian regime or Putin regime been doing over the last decade, unfortunately, it doesn't look like impossible. I think Russian regime can do this.
I wanted to just comment that after RAIN TV finished their final broadcast, they put on a loop of Swan Lake. This was an explicit reference to something Soviet authorities did when they wanted to bury bad news, including the 1991 coup attempt that led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Vlad?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, usually TV was showing something like that when the leader of a country would be dead, actually. So when something like that plays on the TV, people, I mean, a lot of people in Russia start to remember that back in the Soviet times, they could see something like that on the television when the big boss of the Soviet Union could be dead. So now people, well, people still doing jokes about this. And, well, I would probably stop. Yeah.
Finally, Vlad, we have 30 seconds. The significance of the increasing sanctions against the leadership in Russia.
That is very powerful sanctions, and it is very good that the international community introduced so powerful sanctions. It's hitting Russian economy way much, and I think in this situation, that's the only way to stop a war, to cut out resources for continuation of war for a Putin regime.
Are you concerned that increasing the sanctions could lead Putin to take more drastic action?
I think if the rest of the world will not cut out resources for Putin regime, this regime will go into more wars, and there will be bigger war in Europe. So I support every sanction against Putin regime.
Are you afraid to go back to Russia?
Well, I'm afraid, but this is not the most important thing right now. The most important thing right now is peace.
Vladimir Slivyak, I want to thank you for being with us, co-chair of the leading Russian environmental organization, EcoDefense, Right Livelihood Award winner. When we come back, we're going to go to where we started, and that's Ukraine. We're going to speak with a Ukrainian-American journalist who says the Ukraine of his childhood is being erased. Stay with us.
When every time I try, this world is looking for you.
Is looking for you by Algis Harding. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Ukraine of my childhood is being erased. That's the headline of a new piece in the New York Times by Lev Galenkin. He is a Ukrainian-American journalist who came to the U.S. in 1990 as a child refugee from the eastern Ukrainian city of Kharkov, now called Kharkiv. Lev Galenkin is also author of A Backpack, A Bear, and Eight Crates of Vodka, a memoir of Soviet Ukraine. He's joining us from East Windsor, New Jersey. Lev, thanks so much for being with us. You've written so extensively about your country. Talk about your response to what's taking place right now.
We are seeing a repetition of some of the worst things that Russia has done to Ukraine, because when you look at Chernobyl, for example, Chernobyl was not an accident. Chernobyl was the result of Soviet policy, of Soviet refusal to care for human life.
And let's be clear, because Chernobyl was in Soviet Union before it dissolved. And, you know, of course, it's in
correct.
Ukraine.
Correct. But it was inflicted upon—it is in Ukraine. It was inflicted upon Ukraine. And it is—it was the result of Soviet policy of Soviet disregard for safety. What we're witnessing right now is Moscow, again, complete disregard for safety with the attacks on nuclear plants and with a lack of foresight to the horrors that could happen. We also see, for example, there's mixed information about a strike recently on near Babi Yar in Kiev, which is a Nazi killing ground. Unlike what their reports originally said, there's a memorial for Babi Yar. It was not hit. Original reports were saying that it was. It was not hit. But the Russian attack landed near Babi Yar anyway. So we're talking about a sacred ground. We're talking about a killing ground of 33,000 Jews in 2 days by the Nazis in 1941. Afterwards, the Soviet Union forbade Jews to have any communal memory. They did not want Jews. They forbade even a simple memorial saying that here lie murdered Jews in the Holocaust. And now you have Moscow again just recklessly attacking right near a site that has such significance and holds such pain for the Jewish people and for Ukraine in general.
And yet, and isn't again, it interesting, Lev, that this memorial was very controversial at Babi Yar, a famous massacre site. And it was a Russian billionaire, a Jewish Russian billionaire, who was born in Lviv, Mikhail Friedman, who mainly funded the Babi Yar, the latest Babi Yar memorial.
It's a very long and bitter story, because talks are about what the memorial is going to— what is it going to memorize? Because Babi Yar wasn't just carried out by the Nazis. It was carried out with heavy assistance from Ukrainian nationalists, from Ukrainian collaborators. And this is at the center. I write a lot about these things. It's a center of memory wars of who's responsible for what, who did what in World War II. It's also used a lot of times by Russia, who points out how Ukraine is honoring Nazi collaborators. A lot of times Russia also just blows it out of proportion. And there's a lot of just acrimony over it in the memory of Babi Yar. But regardless of what you're doing, if you are an invader claiming that you're protecting Ukrainian Jews and you're protecting, you're fighting back against the Nazis in Ukraine, it kind of goes very much against that when you're bombing one of the most sacred sites of victims of the Nazis. And also, Amy, I just want to point something out to you in the same vein. You spoke to a previous guest about him being a Russian versus Ukrainian in the language. Just so you know, I am from Kharkiv, from Ukraine. I was born there, raised there. I am a native Russian speaker, as are my parents, who were also there. So Putin's lie about how he's protecting Russian speakers, he's not protecting them. He's bombing them. He's killing them right now. All the people that you see are in Kharkiv, 99% chance that anybody who's killed in the city is a native and primary Russian speaker. And these people, they're not Russians. We are Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. We happen to speak a different language, but it's like saying that people in Canada and Quebec, the French speakers, they're still Canadians. They're members of Canada. So that's a very important thing to put out there so people know that the whole notion of Putin saving Russian speakers is garbage. He's not saving them. He's killing them right now.
And Lev, finally, you have written extensively about the far right in Ukraine, and you have Putin saying he's on a denazification campaign. You have fiercely condemned the Russian invasion of your country, of Ukraine. If you can talk about both, how both things can be true.
It is impossible to hold both thoughts in our heads right now. Ukraine does have a neo-Nazi presence, including a neo-Nazi regiment in its armed forces. Okay?
The Azov.
That does not give Russia any reason, any justification to invade an inch of Ukrainian territory. Those two things are true at the same time. What we need to do in America is condemn and fight back Russia, while at the same time making sure we don't have extremists who travel and train with Ukrainian neo-Nazis. And it's extraordinarily frustrating to see people are saying it's one of two things. It's either Putin is a savior on a campaign to free Ukraine, which is garbage, but then people on the other hand say, well, I guess that means that Ukraine doesn't have any neo-Nazis and we shouldn't worry about them. We should. We can support Ukraine, and I believe it is supporting Ukraine to make sure that these far-right groups do not have access to weapons. And I think that's important, not just for Ukraine, but also for America, because we do not want these things coming back in attacks on other places, similar to how Islamic extremists do. And it's important to be able to entertain both things at the same time.
And Lev, how
are
the far right?
At the same time, be careful.
How is the far right? How are the neo-Nazis in Ukraine responding to the Russian invasion? And how are the other Ukrainians responding to them?
This is the Ukrainian far right could not have wished for anything better for this. Okay, they now are it's very much harder. It's harder to criticize them. And they're also now open for recruitment. They've wanted, from the beginning of this conflict, both sides, the separatists and the Ukrainian far right, have attracted neo-Nazis from all over the world to get firsthand experience in battle. So this war could—somebody always benefits from a war. And Ukraine's far right is the primary benefactor on the Ukraine side of this war, because they now get to attract people from all over the world, and they get to be seen as on the front lines of fighting for white civilization. So it's an extremely dangerous thing to look at, and why we should be able to analyze it while also condemning the war crimes that Russia is committing against Ukraine. It should not be difficult to hold both things in focus at the same time.
Well, Lev Galenkin, this is a discussion we have to continue at another point. I thank you so much for being with us, Ukrainian-American journalist who reports extensively on the Ukraine crisis, Russia and the far right, author of A Backpack, A Bear and Eight Crates of Vodka, a memoir of Soviet Ukraine. We will link to your New York Times op-ed, The Ukraine of My Childhood is Being Erased. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. Check out democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Amin Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Werenoff, Camille Baker. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. KKUT 90.3.
Je rêve à Rio, devant ma radio. J'habite un petit haut, dans l'Est sur Rio. C'est pas chaud, chaud, chaud. Je me baigne en photo, dans mes petits journaux. Je vois des vedettes qui payent pas leurs dettes. Avec la palette, moi je mange mon spaghette. J'ai le cœur en mille miettes, gros comme Lise Payette. C'est pas pour moi, tout ça, c'est pour les rois. Là-bas, là-bas, je suis qu'un pauvre homme qui chôme au royaume du calcium. J'ai jamais été plus loin que mon laurier, je me promène à pied, je me suis pas marié, j'ai pas pu trouver, je suis abandonné par ma destinée. Mon meilleur ami, c'est le gars de l'épicerie, ma bière, mes biscuits, j'ai tout à crédit, sauf le vendredi. Arrose la vie.